as we mentioned last week, when we talk about the word salvation, what's the implication behind the need for salvation? Okay, well, just salvation in general. If I need to be saved from something, then what is that generally telling you? Yeah, I'm in trouble, right? I'm in distress. And of course, the greater the salvation, the more distress. So the greatest news, the good news of the gospel about salvation, but as we read in chapters 1 through 3, what's the implication behind that need of salvation? The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against what? All unrighteousness and all ungodliness. And without the gospel, what can we hope for? Just the wrath of God is abiding. The wrath of God is abiding on us. And so when we talk about the good news of salvation, we really need to keep in mind, and this is a very sobering passage. One of the things that I was impressed with as I was going back through it again yesterday is that the Jews and the righteous people were all very confident of what? Their salvation, right? These people had not obeyed the gospel. And the Jews, throughout their history, as we'll see when we get to this section about, they had the law, they had the knowledge of God, they had the name of a Jew, which to them was a name of honor. And yet, what were they? They were hypocrites, weren't they? They were not doing what they were supposed to do. And this is kind of interesting because most people I meet in the denominations and in the Lord's Church, what are they convinced of? Same thing. So this is a sobering passage, and like I say, we're pretty foolish if we don't make a direct application to ourselves here, because if 99% of the human race has fallen because of overconfidence, and what did Paul say in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, 13 and 14? Let him who thinks he take heed lest he fall. And so this isn't a passage for us to read and feel like these people in chapter 2 of, yeah, these people in chapter 1 are sinners, and yeah, these people in chapter 2 are sinners, and yes, those Jews were sinners, but wait a minute, who else might be a sinner? So even though we have obeyed the gospel will do us no more good than the law did to the Jews if we don't what? If we don't believe and we don't, and we're not zealously obeying. So we pick up in verse 12, as many as have sinned without law will also perish without law. Now, this is a question that I've debated back and forth in my own mind, and I've listened to other people talk about, and that is God going to hold people accountable if they didn't know? And what does this verse say? They don't know. They don't know anything about the law. But what does it say? They're going to perish without the law. So regardless of the internal debates that we have and the questions that we have, what we had better be preaching is what is stated here. And that is, if we don't obey the gospel, how much hope can we give to anyone? None. George?
Well, sometimes we forget that from day one, God gave mankind the rules to live by. And that was true when he created Adam and Eve. It was true when Noah and his family came out of the ark. And it's been true ever since. And so if people are sinners, it's their fault, not God's.
Yeah, that's right.
There's also no one who does not know. I mean, remember, he holds us accountable for the things in the universe that we can see.
Well, yeah, there's no excuse for not believing in God. There's no excuse for not searching for him. But what this verse is saying is that even if there is no law, can you sin without law? This verse says you can. Now, what God does is kind of an interesting situation. Because no matter where you go in the world, I mean, if you go back and you read about the ethics of Rome or the ethics of Greece or even the ethics of Babylon, or did they teach basically the same things about murder and adultery and treason and things like that. I mean, were there death penalties back there for doing things that were wrong? Yeah. And so what Paul is saying is that if God can find an ethic in any culture that mirrors his law and they violate that ethic, then what's he able to do? He's able to charge him with sin, because that's what the conscience is for. The conscience is to cause us anguish when we violate a law. So, as I say, Romans 5, we'll get into this a little bit more, where Paul talks about those who did not sin after the likeness of Adam's transgression. Now, what was Adam's transgression? The violation of what? Of a positive direct law. Now, the people after Adam, maybe they didn't have a positive direct law. And yet, what does Paul say? They sinned, but not after the same manner that Adam sinned. Well, then how did they sin? Well, this is the description right here. It says, for as many as have sinned without law will also perish without law, and as many as have sinned in the law will be judged by the law. For not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers of the law will be justified. So we break down this first section, and what we're seeing is that there's an obvious application that whether you have the law or you don't have the law, whether you know about the gospel or you don't know about the gospel, what is God going to be able to do on the judgment day?
Charge you with sin. Accountable.
Okay, yeah. Those without law perish without law. Those that are under the law will be judged by the law. So there's no one who has not obeyed the gospel. And then I think this is a little bit of a dig at the Jews, and maybe even a little bit of dig at Christians, and that is, not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers of the law will be justified. So the truth that these Jews could not quite make out, and remember when we get to chapter 11, what is Paul's hope as he talks about the Gentiles and he talks about how salvation has come to the Gentiles? What was God's plan when he brought the Gentiles in regarding the Jews? Okay, provoke them to jealousy. All right, so we're already starting to do that here. We're already starting to put the needle in, poking it a little bit, because he says, not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers of the law will be justified. Now, verse 14, when the Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do the things of the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves. In other words, every culture has at least, I don't know what the percentages would be, but every culture has, when you look at the Ten Commandments, and you shall not kill, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder. Do most cultures at some point in their development have those laws? Yeah. And so the Gentiles don't have the law. They don't have the law of Moses. But what they do have is they have nature. Now, nature here is describing, well, let me read you the definition of nature, because it's not the same as really as ours. It is the a mode of feeling and acting which by long habit has become nature. The sum of innate properties and powers by which one person differs from others. Distinctive, native peculiarities. So the idea, and I guess I should get on this so I can tell you where that was.
68.
What's that?
68.
Okay. All right. So nature just means what we do naturally based on our culture and what we feel. You know, I made a big blunder a couple of days ago in my article, and Jeff caught it. I said that Joseph quoted scripture to Potiphar's wife. Now, did he quote scripture to Potiphar's wife?
No.
He said, how can I sin before God? Now, where did he get that? There was no law.
He knew.
Well, yeah, he knew it was by nature. I mean, it's just a natural order, the course of things. I remember I didn't know anything about God's law, but I knew by nature things that were right and things that were wrong, and my conscience bothered me. Anybody here not that way? By nature, we grow up with a compass. We grow up with a conscience. We grow up with what's right and what's wrong. And by nature, when we do what the law says and we violate it, then we've sinned. That's what God is saying here. It doesn't take a natural, it doesn't take a direct law from God. It only takes a violation of the conscience based on the truth. Right?
Yeah, and I like to think of it as, we were created in God's image. And we have a conscience, as we're going to read here in just a minute. So I kind of look at it as we're in God's image and we have a conscience. Therefore, we by His nature understand right and wrong. And I don't dismiss the fact that the culture we live in, the circumstances of logic, those things matter. They apply. But at the end of the day, we were created in God's image. And He created us in a way to recognize good and evil at a base level.
Right. Yeah, and we have an eternal soul, and we have the capabilities of discerning these things, and so God just says, it's in every one of you, it's imprinted in you, and when, it's like the animals, when the animals reach a certain age, instinct takes over, and each animal has its own imprinted, in other words, how do these ducks get back and forth all the time, and these geese, it's just in them. And so God here says, when I created you and in my image and after my likeness, and I put these things within you, then you cannot get too far away from it. You will always have it. And that's why He says there's no peace for the wicked. There's no rest for the wicked. And He tells, even of the homosexuals, He says, they're carrying in themselves the recompense that is due. In other words, there's things going on inside of them we can't see, but God can see, that is... they know what they're doing is not appropriate. And so here we see that this nature, when the Gentiles who do not have the law, by nature do the things in the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves. Now, this doesn't mean they're writing their own laws. What this means is, verse 15, they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness. So, how do they show the work of the law written in their hearts? Well, go ahead.
Well, by feeling bad about what they've done, if it's sin.
Okay, feeling bad. How about putting somebody to death? Is that a pretty clear indication of showing the mark of the law? If you're going to put someone to death for murder or treason or cut their hand off for stealing or whatever you choose to do, when that follows along the same lines as the law, then God says, that's all I need. That's all I need to charge you with sin, is when your conscience is bearing witness. And again, it's fascinating to go back and read. These Greek philosophers, as they talk about morality and as they talk about right and wrong and how psychology works, and they nail it. They understand. Even though they don't have the law, they don't know anything about God, they know how man works. And when you unravel how man works and you compare it with the scripture, what do you find out? It's right on the money. This is exactly the way that every culture, even our own culture, I don't care how far away they go, there will still be right and wrong that will be mirrored on Scripture, because the basic fundamental, how man treats man, there's certain boundaries. And so when I feel guilty for committing something that I didn't know was in the Scriptures, but it is in the Scriptures, then what does God say? That's sin. That's where sin occurs. So it wouldn't matter where you were, when you were, how far away you were, how little you knew, the first time you violate your conscience and you commit an act that is against the nature of your culture, which is concurrent with the Scriptures and completely agrees with the Scriptures, then... when God, verse 16, in the day when God will judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel, He will be able to take every one of them and use their conscience, which is bearing witness, and between themselves, their thoughts accusing or else excusing them. Now, this isn't saying that God is going to accuse or excuse based on conscience. It is saying that when you listen to the prosecuting attorney and the defense attorney as they are going back and forth, whether this is in Rome or whether this is in Babylon or whether it's in the culture today. There's accusations, there's excuses, and the jury is looking all that, and can they kind of pick through it and figure out what's right and what's wrong? Well, that's how the judgment day is going to go. So this passage is really emphasizing the fact that God is going to be able to take each individual's thoughts, their conscience. He's going to be able to... Now, did Jesus say something about every idle word is being recorded? And that when we go before God on the judgment day, we're going to give an account of all that we've said and all that we've done and all that we've thought? That all of this is going to be there? And I say to God, well, God, I don't remember that. Can he play that back for me and show me exactly how it went? And say, oh yeah, now I remember. So he's going to be able to do that with every human being. And there's not going to be anyone who's going to be able to say, Lord, it's not fair for you to cast me into eternal torment just because I didn't obey the gospel, because I didn't know. Then God will be able to go back and say, but wait a minute. Your conscience was plaguing you here. You knew you needed to do something to fix this. And then over here, you heard about the gospel. You didn't make the connection. That's your problem. That's not my problem. All right. Any other thoughts on that? I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this. Okay, Brian and Rob.
Yeah, just a quick thought. So that's what makes searing our consciences so scary. Because obviously you don't have that feeling anymore. And then the other part is just self-deception. So you're talking about denominations or other religions feeling like they're acceptable to God and missing the part that if they don't follow the gospel exactly, they're not going to be acceptable to God because there's no partiality. So between that and searing our conscience, it can send us down a path where it's almost a point of no return, right? Yeah. Unless we get it together.
Well, and that's what he just told those people in the previous chapter. After your hardness and impenitent heart, are you storing up for yourself wrath and indignation? And I don't know if everyone is different or not, but it seems to me like when you violate your conscience, there's a sense of fear that is created that needs to be acted on. And as you say, if you don't act on it, then what happens? You sear your conscience. Rob?
Well, along the same lines, as we look at what else is taught in the scriptures, you know, God is no respecter of person, and God's will is that all men will be saved. So if you reconcile those two things together, God has a plan that all men can be saved, and it's through what they do and what his part is. And so we may not fully be able to understand from day one till now, but man is going to have an opportunity to accept or reject God's word.
Right.
And we often get questions to our website, you know, about not knowing or ignorance is bliss. And, you know, in this day and time, forget it. Okay. We have the word. It's very accessible and you know, all that. It's just so like you were saying at the beginning of class, our application now is we know. There's no doubt. We have the word. We're going to be judged by that.
Right. Yeah, I think that one of the things we really need to appreciate, even though because of sin things are so skewed, when water is at the top of the hill and you pour it out, what's its natural course?
Go down.
It's going to go down. Now, if it hits a rock, what's it going to do? Well, then it's going to go around. But if the rock is creating a pool, then what does it do? Well, it can't go any further. And I think that's really what is the way God created each one of us, is that morally, once we sin, we are like that water and we're seeking a way to resolve that problem. The problem is, on the way to resolving that problem, what happens to most people? Because God has given the gospel, and he's been very clear. We've dealt with this quite a few times now. If you're seeking me with your whole heart, does it matter where you are? Can I bring you back? God says, I can bring you back. So the problem is not that man can't find his way back. The problem is he stopped looking. He stopped searching. And you look at the people who actually become Christians, and you look at how the process by which, especially if they didn't know anything about God and they didn't even know if there was a God, and you see the process that brings them back. And it's just like water going down a hill. I mean, it's just this naturally occurred and this naturally occurred and this naturally occurred. And like Ken was pointing out earlier, because of the physical creation, how can we not at least consider whether there's a God or not? And then, once we consider that, then what do we have to do? And then we are drawn relentlessly. God wants all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. The gospel and the way he created man and the way that this is all set up and our conscience and everything is working together, and it would bring us to God if it weren't for these little rocks, these little pockets, like Jesus described in the sermon on the, or the parable of the sower. There's people that are just hardened. A lot of people just hardened. Then there's people who are, there's rocks, there's pockets of rocks in their hearts that they haven't removed. There's people who have thorns. All right, any other? Okay, let's start verse 17 then. Now we're going to move to the Jews. We started with the Gentiles. We started with those first generation apostates. We started with those people who knew God but didn't glorify him as God. And then we came to these people who know enough about morality and enough about God to condemn these people but minimize their own sins. And now we come to the Jews. And so he begins, if you are called a Jew and rest on the law and make your boast in God and know his will and approve the things that are excellent, being instructed out of the law and are confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those in the darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes, having the form of knowledge and truth in the law. So, is that a lot to be confident about? I mean, are any of those things not wonderful blessings that each person should want? So, you are called a Jew. Now, it's interesting. What were they called when Abraham came out of Ur? You remember when Potiphar's wife accused Joseph? She said, this man is a what? Okay, a Hebrew. So, the term Hebrew was used until Joseph, and it continued to be used, because what did Paul say about himself in Philippians chapter 1? A Hebrew of Hebrews. So that's a complimentary name. After Joseph wrestled with God, what was the name?
Israel.
So Israel, which means El is God, and Israel has the idea of contending with God and coming out victorious. So Israel was used pretty much until the time of the carrying away of the people into captivity, and then what name took over?
Jew.
And it's not a term of derision. It's actually a term of nationality, probably coming from Judah and just shortening Judah to Jew and describing them as the Jews. Doesn't really matter. Is this an insult or a compliment when he says you're called a Jew? A compliment. It's a compliment. So Hebrew to Israel to Jew, and they all basically mean the same thing. They are the description of God's chosen people. They're a description of the children of Abraham. They're a description of those of whom the world is not worthy. So these were God's people. And you're resting on the law. Now, resting here has the idea of support. My support is I possess the law. Now, was that what God gave the law for? Well, partially, yeah. Let me catch up here on our pages.
Bottom of 71.
Thanks, Jeff. Okay, that passage at the very bottom there, Deuteronomy chapter 4 on page 71. I won't read the whole thing, but it is a high, God is giving them the amazing nature of the privilege of what they have. This is your wisdom, your understanding in the sight of the peoples that you hear these statutes. They will say, surely this great nation is wise and understanding, for what great nation is there that has such amazing statutes and commands? So resting on the law, again, that's not the problem. The problem is to whom much is given?
Much
is expected. And so the higher we go here, the worse their situation is when they won't do what God asks them to do. Now, they glory in God. Now, in on page 72 there, Jeremiah chapter 9, don't glory in your wisdom, don't glory in your might, don't glory in your riches. What should you glory in?
God.
That you know me. So, should we glory in God? Yeah, absolutely. These are, now, we could do the same thing. We could make the same comments. We could say that we bear the name of a Christian. And we rest on the gospel. And we glory in God. Now, but when we get to the very bottom there and it says, are you dishonoring God by the way you're living your life? Then we come back to the same problem. So, glory in God, then you know his will. And so, God made known his will to his people. They had insights into the past, into the future, that no one else had. And so, this too was something that they should feel very special about. Now, approving the things that are excellent. This is a phrase that is used in one of Paul's prayers also. Exactly, almost the same vocabulary. So, approving the things that are excellent is made up of two words. So, let's look at them. They're on the top of page 73. The first one is to test, to examine, to prove, to scrutinize. So, as I go through life, I test, I scrutinize, I prove, I take a look at things, and then what I find is, and I think Diaphero is pretty much 6-1, half a dozen the other. That's kind of what this means. It's just to bear or carry through in different ways. So, it basically means to distinguish between things that have very fine distinctions. In other words, if I can carry the water in a bucket or I can carry the water in a watering can, what difference does it make? Well, it depends on what you're going to do with water. If you're going to water, which one should you pick?
Watering can.
You should pick the watering can. Well, what if you're going to just wash the car? Which one should you pick?
Bucket.
Well, just take the bucket. So, what am I doing? I'm approving the things that are excellent. In other words, I'm making these defined distinctions. I'm making the difference. This is basically what Cain didn't do and Abel did. Abel made the fine distinctions. What did Cain say? 6-1, half dozen the other. Whether I bring this or whether I bring this, and it makes me happier to bring this. Well, what did Abel say? We need to make a fine distinction here. What about Nadab and Abihu? Were they able to prove the things that are excellent? To them, a coal is a coal is a coal. 6-1, half dozen the other. But what did God say?
No.
You can't have that coal. You have to have this coal. What about Uzzah and David? 6-1, half dozen the other. Throw it on the ark. Carry it on your shoulders. Doesn't make any difference. Well, did it? Yeah, so sometimes, and I think as a people, members of the Lord's church are very accustomed to this, to making those defined distinctions, to approving the things that are excellent. To the denomination, singing with instrumental music, singing without instrumental music, what do they say? What difference does it make? 6-1, half dozen the other, doesn't matter. We think it's better to do it because it makes us happier, but if you don't want to do it, well, that's fine. Well, what do we see? Well, we see a fine distinction there. Sing and make melody in your heart. Now, so we make that fine distinction, and they don't. And let's be honest with ourselves. Does that make you happy? Does that make you feel pretty good about yourself that you're making those fine distinctions and they're not? I mean, we're supposed to feel good about that. That's what makes us his people, and that's what disqualifies them from being his people. And so when Paul prays that we'll be able to make these fine distinctions, that we'll be able to approve the things that are excellent, then, and you can see where the translators really struggled, because how do you translate bearing or carrying things through in different ways? How do you make that? So, as I say, the basic concept here is that these are the fine distinctions that need to be made in order to truly show that we love and are devoted to God. And as I said, God has given example after example after example in the Old Testament and command after command after command in the New Testament. But it's interesting, you know, Luke 11 there at the top of page 73, about two inches down. You tithe mint, rue, and every herb, Now, should they have done that? Is that a fine distinction? To count up all the tiny little herbs in your garden and then give one out of ten to God, so you're sitting there all day counting this pile? And if it were me, I'd just give them 50% and let it go at that, because then I'd know I was okay. But they would sit down and they'd actually count it up. Now, some people today tell us, well, that's legalism. But what did Jesus say? He said, these you ought to have done. So you should make the fine distinctions. I expect you to make the fine distinctions. It would be like if you get a job and you're watching these products go down through the line, you're supposed to pull it off if there's something wrong with it. And here's your criteria, but you're letting half of them through. What's your boss going to say? You're not making a fine enough distinction. Well, yeah, that's probably what he'd say. But maybe the first time he'd say, look, we sat down, we explained this to you. If you see this, 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 or that, take it off. And because you're not distinguishing clearly and tightly enough, and you're destroying our quality control. So either shape up or you're out of here. And why people can see that in manufacturing and they can't see it in the scriptures has always been amazing to me. But anyway, that's what these Jews had, and that's what they were doing. At least in their own mind, that's what they were doing. So they were making these fine distinctions. They were instructed out of the law. Okay, so is a good education prized today in our culture? Yeah, if you've gone to Harvard, if you've gone to Princeton, if you've got a PhD, that means something to the people of this world. Doesn't mean too much to us because, well, we'll do that. But these people were instructed out of the law. And so they had this sense. Deuteronomy 6 there, right in the middle of the page. You diligently teach them to your children. And as Paul told Timothy, from a babe you've known the sacred writings. And so we need to give this to our children. This is something that we need to teach our children about. All right, so that's their attitude. That's how they saw themselves. And now we continue on and we talk about their confidence. You're confident that you're a guide to the blind, a light of them that are in darkness. So was this their role? Yeah, this was their role. They were supposed to show people how to live, and they were very very confident that they were manifesting that to the lost and dying world. Verse 20, a corrector of the foolish. So this was a feeling that they had about themselves, and again, that's how it should have been. But and it was on a, how would I put this? It was on a very low level, but on a true level, all of this was a sham. All of this was false. They had this sense, and on a very lower level, they were manifesting these things. But as Jesus said, when you're finished with them, they're twofold more a son of hell than they were before you got a hold of them. So Jesus was not at all impressed with this assessment that they had made of themselves. So, continuing on the top of page 75, they were teachers of babes. Now, again, I can't read this, and you can't read this, without feeling the same senses. In other words, as a member of the Church of Christ, as a member of the Lord's Church, I think that most of us have the same kinds of emotions, rightfully or wrongfully so, and that's why I made the point all the way through. There's nothing wrong with these emotions as long as when you get all down to the bottom, you're actually living the life of a Christian. Or in this case, you're actually living the life of a Jew. But the problem was that although they had this confidence, the sad reality was, as he's going to conclude in verse 24, the name of God is what? Blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. So what does that do with all of those claims? I mean, as Jesus said, look at the fruits. Don't listen to what they're saying. These teachers come to you and they've got all these wonderful, they're sheep in wolves' clothing and you can't see anything at all about them. Just look at the fruits. So what is the fruit of the Jews regarding the Gentiles? Well, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. So it doesn't matter what you claim. And the same thing is true for God's people. If because of the way we actually live our Christian life out among the people, their sense of the Lord's church is a negative thing. And I'm not talking about legitimate persecution. I'm talking about a legitimate conclusion. We're not really upholding the name of the Christian the way that we should. Then we would find ourselves in the same situation. But what's Paul trying to do here? What was he trying to do with those people who were confident that they were judging the wicked people, and therefore God must think they're pretty special because they could see how wicked they were? What does he do with their confidence?
Tries to introduce them to the truth.
He tries to remove it. And I think I mentioned this a few weeks ago. The hardest thing to give someone as far as spiritual growth is to get them to see that they have a problem. That's the biggest problem that we face. Is, and I dealt with this a little bit in the article I wrote yesterday, the fact that it's very difficult. Without the scriptures, it's almost impossible for us to see ourselves because we kind of pick and choose through the events, and we see ourselves as a pretty good guy. But how does the proverb put it? Every man's cause seems just until what?
Until another man examines.
Until we examine the neighbor. And I can tell you all day long how great I am, but somebody who's actually working with me, why does God want us to have go talk to the unbelievers about this prospective elder? What does he need to have?
A different perspective.
A good reputation among those who are outside. Well, why should we care about that? Well, because that's where the rubber meets the road, right? I mean, how people observed you. And a good reputation manifests something, and a bad reputation manifests. So don't listen to what people tell you about themselves. Go find out what other people say about them. That's why the proverb says, let another praise thee and not your own lips. That's a tough proverb, isn't it? Don't we want to tell people all the wonderful things we are and do? Let another praise thee and not your own lips. That's why Jesus says, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. I see him.
Just say it's really hard with writing a resume.
Let me write your resume. Rob.
Well, as you're pointing out, you know, the Jews are God's chosen people, and we're God's chosen people today. And if you want to know what our dangers can be, yeah, look at the Jews. Look at, you know, they thought because of their heritage, they thought because they were God's people that he was going to overlook things, or they were going to be saved unconditionally. Throughout the history of the Bible, just if you really know all about the Jews and what they were about, we can fall into the same exact trap as God's people. We have to be careful.
Yeah, and as I say, as I was studying that in the last few weeks, it's just kind of become more and more powerful how crucial it is, because don't we kind of rely on the grace of God? He's going to cover all this stuff over here that I'm not doing. Well, how far can we pick that? How far can we take that?
Probably not as far as we
see. And that's what I'm concerned about. I mean, there's so many places in the scriptures that say many have gone through the path that leads to destruction, and how many are on the path that leads to life? Just a few. We say, oh, well, that just means everyone in the Church of Christ. Well, does it?
No.
Many are called, few are chosen. So even in the, quote, Church of Christ, it's going to be real difficult to get into heaven. George?
Well, our culture today, specifically in the United States, is that the name Christian is kind of like the Jew here, that as long as you call yourself a Christian, you can approve things like homosexuality, same-sex marriages, and et cetera, et cetera, because you're a Christian, and kind of like Paul's been teaching here.
Right. And it's interesting when you get out of this culture and you go to another culture where they think these things are wrong. For example, in the Muslim culture, how does a Muslim culture view homosexuality?
Like we used to.
So when they hear that these churches are agreeing that it's okay, what are they going to be thinking?
The Christians think it's okay.
Well, yeah, and they're going to say that religion is wrong. That's a blasphemous religion if that's how they're going to take it. And so, and even Peter makes that point. Because of the wickedness of the false teachers, the way of truth will be evil spoken of or blasphemed. And the key is we don't want to be one of those people. We don't want to be one of those people that is doing that. We want to be a people who not only are glorying in all these things, because there's nothing wrong with glorying in them, but much more importantly, we're actually doing them. Ken?
Yeah, just saying that the Muslim world calls the United States the Great Satan, and I can understand what they're talking about.
Well, that's not what they mean, but yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
The entire nation could be devout members of the Lord's church doing everything that God commanded, and how would the Muslims see us?
It's the same way, I guess.
They'd still see us as the Great Satan. So.
Yeah, we don't acknowledge Muhammad. That's a problem.
Right. That's a problem. Thanks for the correction.
Oh, well, it wasn't a correction per se. It was just a further enlightenment, because part of what you're saying is true, but part of it's not. All right. Jason, was that the first bell or second bell? First bell. Okay. All right, then. Let's continue here. You are confident, verse 19, that you are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes. Then, having the form of knowledge and truth in the law. Now, it's interesting. Paul's going to come back to this in chapter 10. And he's going to say that they have a form of righteousness, but what? But they would not submit themselves to the true righteousness of God. And so the form of knowledge and truth in the law, is it the same as the form of the knowledge and truth in the gospel? Now remember, the word form, let me make sure it's the same word. Okay, where is it?
Top of 75.
Morphos.
Okay, it is the same word then. It's the same word in Philippians 2. Jesus was dwelling in the form of God, but he emptied himself and took on the form of a servant. So the term form, and it can also come from the Greek word schemos, from which we get the word schematic. Morphos, though, like metamorphosis, means to change your form. So the law has a form. And that form is the temple in Jerusalem and animal sacrifices and priesthood and tithes and keeping the law of Moses. Now, what's the form of the gospel? A little bit different? Yeah, very different. The form of the gospel, the outward form of the gospel, is that we are serving Christ, we are following Christ's law, and we are worshiping God in spirit and in truth. And so if you compare the form of those who live in the law and those who live under the gospel, are they the same at all? So they're not even close to the same. They serve an altar, but we have an altar that they have no right to. So there's a totally different form, and Hebrews is going to deal with that, that the new tabernacle is not of this creation. So, but these people are practicing a form. Excuse me. I lost it again. There it is, verse 20. Having the form of knowledge and truth in the law. So there's an outward form that should strike the eye of a person who is truly following the law, and they thought that they had it. But sadly, the form of knowledge and truth that they had, what did Jesus say about it in Matthew 23? Hypocrites. And he just nails them again and again and again. Your form and your understanding of the law is completely wrong. The knowledge and truth that you are manifesting with your morphos is completely wrong. All right, we'll go ahead and stop there. I may touch briefly on this again next week, but we'll probably jump right into verse 21. So let's go ahead and we'll stop there. Thank you.